Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and it's official. New York City public advocate Bill de Blasio is the latest to throw his hat in the ring for mayor for this year. He made it official yesterday, and we're happy he's joining us today to talk about his brand new campaign. Public advocate de Blasio, welcome back to WNYC.
Hey, Brian, how you doing?
Great. Why do you want to be mayor?
I think we need some real changes in this city. I think we need a focus on our neighborhoods. I think we need a government that believes all boroughs are created equal and wants to make sure that people have opportunity across every neighborhood of the city. I think we need some serious changes in education, a real focus on early childhood and after-school programs that has been missing in recent years. I think we have to be willing to say to those who are the wealthiest among us that we need their help. So that our kids can succeed and our school system can really turn the corner. And I also think when it comes to some of the real inequities in this city, growing income disparity, a broken stop and frisk policy, the absence of paid sick leave legislation, I think these issues must be addressed. And they haven't been by Mayor Bloomberg, and they won't be by candidates who want to continue his legacy as is.
What did you mean by all boroughs being created equal? Do you think the Bloomberg administration has favored some boroughs over others?
Look, I think it's no secret that this mayor has a pretty elitist worldview. He clearly doesn't see what life is like the farther you go out in the boroughs. I think if you talk to folks who experienced Sandy in places like Coney Island or Garrison Beach or Midland Beach in Staten Island, Rockaways, I think people would say they don't feel the response has been strong enough or consistent enough, and it's not disconnected to the fact that the mayor's field of vision doesn't get that far out of Manhattan. I think New Yorkers appreciate the fact that it takes five boroughs to make this city work. It takes every kind of people, every kind of income level. That's the powerful, beautiful history of this place, every kind of people. But policies in recent years have, I think, favored the chosen few. It's really been a tale of two cities that a lot of the mayor's worldview and policies have been focused on things like tourism or Wall Street or tech, and those are not bad in and of themselves. We need that. But I want to rebalance the equation and make sure we're just as concerned about our small businesses, which are real job creation engines. We're just as concerned about neighborhood quality of life. We're just as concerned about schools in the outer boroughs that haven't been succeeding and that we are going to, for example, respect parents in our public schools. This has been a huge missing link. I don't think this mayor understands how crucial the role of parents are in the educational process, how much their voices matter, which is why it's easy for him to close schools, I think, on a whim or co-locate schools without a real consultation with parents. All of that needs to change if this city is going to do as well as it should do.
Would you cut back on the expansion of charter schools in general, and would you change the mayor's position on teacher evaluations?
I'm certainly not looking for an expansion of charter schools, but I do want to be clear. I believe that some charter schools have played a valuable role. Some have served where traditional public schools didn't. So I'm comfortable with the charter schools being a piece of the puzzle, but not looking for an expansion, certainly not looking for the approach, for example, Eva Moskowitz has taken in trying to extend charters, rampantly. On the question of evaluations, look, I think Governor Cuomo got it right. I think the bill that was passed in Albany proved that you could have a forthright, clear, fast evaluation structure that just in the course of 2 years could make sure that the minority of teachers who don't belong in the profession could be weeded out. And I think the mayor had a chance to come to a similar deal here and blew it. And we've obviously potentially going to lose a lot of money in the bargain. This mayor obsesses with the small number of folks who shouldn't be teaching rather than the vast majority who I think are devoted and with the right support and help could become much better teachers.
New York City public advocate Bill de Blasio, who officially declared his intention to run for mayor yesterday. And I heard that you had raised taxes on some people to fund certain education initiatives. Is that accurate?
That's absolutely right, Brian. For the folks who have done best in the city, the wealthiest, I respect them and I appreciate their achievements. But for folks who make a half million or more, We need to ask their help to help our kids. For example, a family making $1 million under my plan would pay $2,000 more a year in city taxes for the next 5 years. That would give us about $500 million a year. That would allow us to do truly universal pre-K, not this mythology of universal pre-K we have right now, but full day, 6 hours a day, pre-K for all 68,000 kids who need it. Right now, you got 10,000 kids in New York City who have no access to pre-K who need it. You've got 38,000 who only get 3 hours a day, which is insufficient. It's not going to get them ready for their future education. It doesn't work for parents' schedules. And that same tax plan would provide after-school enrichment, educational-oriented after-school programs, 3 to 6 p.m. for every middle school child who needs it. That would really help us turn our schools around. And if the wealthiest among us contribute in that fashion, I think it will have a great, positive, lasting effect for the city.
You mentioned stop and frisk in your announcement yesterday, and you noted that your wife is black, so you have a son who will be identified by police as black. How do you think your family situation influences your position on stop and frisk?
I think it helps me see what the vast majority of New Yorkers experience every day. I mean, I think in so many communities of color, young men are challenged every day unfairly. You know, we're talking about law-abiding young men. And remember that the police department's own statistics say that almost 90% of those stopped have done nothing wrong. There's no summons or any kind of follow-up because they haven't done anything wrong. Vast majority of those are young men of color. It's not helping us to build a more equal, more productive society for them to constantly be treated as suspects. It doesn't make us safer. It breeds distrust in communities between community and police. I think for police to be safe and for communities to be safe, police and community must be unified, communicative, working in partnership. So what I've said is stop and frisk is a valid policing tool that's being overused. It must be brought down to a more reasonable level. I've suggested the CompStat system is the way to do it, to figure out the right use precinct by precinct and no more than that which is necessary. And, yes, of course I know my own son, who's almost 6 feet tall, happens to have a large afro, could be walking down the street, and he easily could be a classic example of a young man who's stopped, even if he's doing nothing wrong. And that's not the society we're trying to build.
Now, Mayor Bloomberg might say he's just being consistent as the pro-public health, anti-gun mayor. So he's leading the charge for new gun laws in Washington, and he's leading the charge against getting guns off the street for getting guns off the street with stop and frisk, which is essentially an anti-gun program. He might ask, can you be anti-gun and anti-stop and frisk?
Well, 2 points. One, I think the mayor's been very good on the gun issue. I think his national leadership has been essential, and I would want to continue that as mayor for sure. I'd also want to deepen it. And you may have seen the last few days, I'm leading an effort around the country to get pension funds to divest in the guns and ammunition industry and get private asset managers, big investment houses, to turn away from that industry in a serious way. That industry also supports the NRA and funds the NRA, and so there's a crucial opportunity here to go farther even than the mayor's approach and really get to the root of the problem. But that being said, to the question of stop and frisk, look, you can't use a valid policing tool in an invalid manner. You can't overuse it and constantly go at law-abiding folks where there's no specific reason to suspect them, no specific description or other reason for policing to happen. If you do that on the notion that maybe you'll find some guns out there in the bargain, well, how about, you know, warrants when it comes to searching our apartments? You know, are we going to say, well, we're going to no longer focus on that constitutional guarantee of our liberties because maybe some people have a gun in their apartment? No, we have a system of laws and due process, and we should follow it because it's, first of all, what we believe in this country and this city. But second, it's effective. If the community knows police are only pursuing people for a specific reason and they consistently see that and believe it, the best allies, the best information sources for police will be community members who are only going to go to every extent possible to help the police do their job. But if they feel their law-abiding fellow citizens are constantly targeted, it will create a dangerous rift between police and community. It already has in some neighborhoods.
You're clearly making a case that the city needs to change some Bloomberg policies because they're too elitist. Is your argument against Christine Quinn going to be that she's too much like the mayor on too many things?
Look, today I'm talking about my vision. I think the basic answer to your question is yes, but there'll be plenty of time going forward for a more detailed analysis and comparison. But the bottom line is this status quo does not make sense for the future of our city. You can't have, for example, the greatest income disparity since the Great Depression, but not being a willingness at City Hall to address serious living wage legislation or paid sick days for the million-plus New Yorkers who don't have it. We're not taking seriously as a city government what we have to do to get people back to work and get our, you know, get small business in a position where they can employ more people. So I don't want to continue this status quo. I will tell you that some of the mayor's policies on public health or mayoral control education or some of his national work must be continued. But if any of my opponents want to essentially have a fourth Bloomberg administration, I think they won't be serving the people of this city.
And let me ask you about one of your other opponents, presumed opponents in the race, John Liu, who was here the other day, and he's trying to establish himself as a major progressive in the race as well, proposing things like an $11.50 an hour minimum wage, a living wage to replace the minimum wage. And also, he said, no more tax subsidies for major companies, claiming that, you know, the tax subsidy would help them create jobs because there isn't enough of a track record. Would you go that far on either of those two things?
Well, I respect John. I disagree with him on some important issues. For example, he wants to abolish the use of stop and frisk. I think it needs to be reformed, but not abolished. I certainly believe in raising the minimum wage, but I would differentiate a raise in the minimum wage versus living wage legislation, which gets to the level that John's talking about. But living wage legislation is based on the notion that's where the city is providing specific subsidies to specific companies, that in the bargain we need a living wage for our people. So I have some common ground with John, but I think in a couple of those cases he's proposing things that I don't think will work as well as the reforms I'm talking about.
They go too far? Are they irresponsible?
Well, I think to abolish stop and frisk would be irresponsible. I think we need it as a policing tool. But let me give you an example, Brian. Stop and frisk, in the first two Bloomberg years with Ray Kelly as commissioner, about 100, 150,000 stops a year. Earlier this year, we were on a pace by police statistics for almost 800,000 stops, so a five-fold increase in the course of a decade. So that points out that when we were using stop and frisk at a valid level, it was a valuable policing tool. That's where I want to get us back to, a level that actually works for police and communities alike. John, I think, is wrong to say abolish it. I think we would be taking a tool out of the police's hands that they should use when they use it right.
A lot of people don't realize that we have a 21% poverty rate in New York City. It's gone up the last 3 years, even as the economy has recovered for some other New Yorkers. Would you have an anti-poverty platform that you could articulate at this time?
Well, absolutely. You know, when I was in the city council, I was the chairman of the Social Services Committee called the General Welfare Committee. And in many ways, I think we've missed opportunities over the Bloomberg years to address poverty. One in five New Yorkers being below the federal poverty level is absolutely unacceptable. Unemployment now still hovering around 9%. So I would suggest a combination of things. One, the immediate tools the government has at its disposal locally, things like living wage, but a serious living wage package. The current bill passed by the council only reaches a few hundred workers. We need to reach every conceivable worker we can in those cases where we specifically subsidize businesses and development. Again, something like a paid sick leave legislation has a huge impact because a lot of folks right now could lose their job or certainly will lose one or more days' pay if they don't have those coverages. So that really makes a difference, a bread and butter difference for families. Beyond that, the job creation pieces that I'm talking about, ending the practice of the horrendous fining of small businesses that's inhibiting job growth, and it's inhibiting grassroots job growth, particularly outer borough, particularly immigrant small businesses. Investing pension fund money here in the city, Brian, it's an astounding fact. We have over $120 billion in pension investment. We're putting about 1% of that into job creation and affordable housing creation in the city. It's a lost opportunity of a massive proportion. Other states and cities are doing much better than New York City. That's a change we have to make. I think if you add all of those pieces and then on top of it, really go after the problem of early childhood education after school, which again can only be achieved by a tax increase on those who are wealthiest. If you get early childhood education right, you set up the dynamic where kids can succeed in school regardless of whether they come from an advantaged background or not. Then they're ready for the modern workforce. That sets us up for much greater equity and a real fight on poverty going forward.
Bill de Blasio, New York City public advocate, now officially running for mayor as of yesterday. Before you go, you or one of your Democratic competitors may actually be elected mayor this year, though that is not certain. Why do you think in this bluest of blue cities the people haven't elected a Democratic mayor since 1989?
I've thought about this a lot, to say the least, and I was involved in the 1989 and 93 campaigns as a member of the Democratic side staff. And so, look, first, this time I am absolutely convinced it's a Democratic year because of what's happened nationally, the reelection of President Obama, the fact that Democratic registration in the city has actually gone up substantially. I think there is a fatigue about some of the mistakes of the Bloomberg years and the way he got his third term, the way he changed term limits. I think it's a Democratic moment, unquestionably. But to your core question, look, I think Democrats made mistakes. I think, and I had a front row seat for this. I think we needed to keep showing people a vision of specific change in their lives, and we didn't do that sufficiently. I think, Rudy Giuliani unfortunately played the race card and was divisive at a moment in our history where that helped him win some votes. I think, thank God, the city has changed in a lot of ways. So I think there are very specific mistakes on the Democratic side and some unusual circumstances that, particularly in the case of 9/11, that also may have aided the Republican. But I don't think it reflected the core beliefs of this city. This is a very progressive and Democratic city, and I think the pendulum's about to swing back.
All right. Bill de Blasio, New York public advocate, now mayoral hopeful. By the way, our next segment, and now I'm really going to throw you a curveball, okay? Our next segment is going to be about the Times Square businesses trying to come up with a design to bring New Yorkers into Times Square to play, even though we love to avoid the Times Square area for the most part. You didn't know this was coming, but do you have any ideas for how to make New Yorkers want to go and play in Times Square?
Well, Brian, you certainly have framed the challenge, because I think you're right. All of us, including those of us who drive cars, such as myself, we don't necessarily seek out Times Square. I'm glad our tourist friends do, which has been very good for the city, but that's a tall order. Maybe the greatest asset of Times Square being the theater district around it. Maybe that's the ticket, but I'll have to give that one some thought.
And maybe that's the best we can do. We'll see what other people come up with here in our next segment. Bill de Blasio, thank you so much.
Thank you, Brian.